Hello and welcome to the Alcohol Alert, brought to you by the Institute of Alcohol Studies. On this month's podcast, we spoke to John Holmes, Professor of Alcohol Policy at the University of Sheffield, about no and low alcohol products. We discussed the project the Sheffield Alcohol Research Group is running, why these products are gaining attention, who uses these products, the concerns among public health groups, and what the market for such products will look like in the coming years. First, Professor Holmes explained what is meant by no and low alcohol products.
No and low alcohol drinks are beers, wines, ciders, spirits, alcopops or ready to drinks that contain little or no alcohol. And in the UK, we tend to mean products with no more than 1.2% alcohol by volume. Although that definition actually differs across countries, and some people think that low alcohol drinks include those products up to 3.5%, so almost the strength of a standard beer. And other people say, well, we're really talking about drinks that have little, almost no alcohol at all in, so maybe just 0.05 alcohol by volume. But broadly, yeah, little or no alcohol.
That actually does raise a question that I haven't briefed you on already, that there's a sort of labelling confusion, I think, as well, that some you see will refer to no alcohol as being 0.05, because I think that's what the regulations are in the UK, but then other companies seem to ignore that and seem to have no alcohol or zero alcohol, meaning 0.5.
That's right. The use of those descriptors for non-alcoholic and low alcohol drinks are voluntary in the UK. And to add to the confusion, they're also, if you're producing your product in another European country, you only have to abide by the rules of that country and not by the UK when you export it for sale in the UK. So we get products on UK shelves that describe themselves as low alcohol or non-alcoholic, which don't actually meet the definitions that the government says people should use. And the government consulted on and improving that system at the end of last year, and we're still waiting to hear the outcome of it. But broadly, the government says that a alcohol-free drink is one that contains less than 0.005% alcohol by volume, so almost no alcohol at all, trace amounts. And that a low alcohol drink is up to 0.5% alcohol by volume. And as I say, we also use a more general category of low alcohol drinks going up to 1.2%. So it's a really messy system.
So within this conversation, we'll mostly be talking about drinks from essentially zero alcohol to 1.2%. You're the director of the Sheffield Alcohol Research Group, and the group's been doing lots of research, really interesting research, on no and low alcohol products. Could you briefly explain what the project is sort of looking at and what you're conducting?
Yeah, so we have a large grant from the National Institute for Health Research to look at the public health impact of no and low alcohol drinks. And this came about because the government, the UK government, has committed to increasing the availability and consumption of these products as part of its prevention in the 2020s strategy for public health. So our aim is basically to say, well, is the government achieving this aim, and is it likely to be improving public health? And we're going to do that by looking at quite a wide range of different pieces of research, different ways of looking at what's happening in this space. So that includes looking at what the alcohol industry is doing in terms of producing new drinks, marketing them, getting them into stores. It includes looking at what the government is doing in terms of regulation, and also what charities and social enterprises are doing to promote these drinks. We know, for example, that Alcohol Change UK has done a lot to promote no and low alcohol drinks within its Dry January campaigns. So that's one part. Another part is going to have a look, well, what impact does all that activity have on people's consumption of these drinks? And crucially, if people drink more no and low alcoholic drinks, do they drink less standard alcoholic drinks and thus drink less alcohol overall? We're going to try and understand what impact all this might be having on some specific subgroups in the population, such as pregnant women, young people who are under the legal alcohol purchasing age, and also people who are trying to reduce their alcohol consumption or are in recovery from alcohol dependence. And we're particularly interested in those groups, because that's where we might see some unintended consequences. So we might see no and low alcohol drinks encouraging young people to take up alcohol consumption earlier than they would otherwise. Or we might find that these products also make it harder in some way for people to stay abstinent when they're trying to drink less, such as when they're pregnant or when they're recovering from alcohol dependence. On the other hand, they might be helpful, but we do want to look at these groups to see, well, what is going on in these particularly high risk populations. And then lastly, we're going to use all of that information to try and model what the health impacts of this would be. So if we see falls in alcohol consumption as a result of people taking up no and low alcohol drinks, what does that do to the long-term health consequences in England from alcohol? Does it reduce deaths? Does it reduce hospitalizations? Does it reduce healthcare costs?
So the group's research sounds brilliant, and it sounds like exactly the sort of thing that we need to understand, of course. But why is the group focusing on that? And as a sort of wider question to that, why are these products being increasingly discussed across the government, the media, and the alcohol industry, and of course, public health too?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably easier to take the second part of that question first. So the reason these products are being discussed is because they're increasingly prominent in the alcohol market. We've seen a real growth in the production and sales of no and low alcohol drinks over the last 10 years, and particularly since around 2018. So whereas maybe 20, 30 years ago, a non-alcoholic beer was often kind of a very much a secondary choice. They were often renowned to be quite poor quality products, not very flavoursome, not very appealing, only available in a very small number of places. And most people saw them as something you drank if you couldn't drink alcohol for some reason. That's really changed in recent years. We've seen much more interest from consumers in reducing their alcohol consumption, having alternatives that are still what sometimes get called adult drinks. So flavoursome, complex drinks that make them feel like they're having an alcoholic drink, but are healthier, that contain less alcohol, don't have the negative effects. And the industry has responded to this, partly because the technology has improved. So one of the difficulties with making good quality no and low alcohol drinks is you've got to get the alcohol out of the product. It's much easier to make a flavoursome drink if the alcohol is in there in the first place, but then trying to get it out often damages the flavor. But technological improvements over recent years mean that the industry can now produce much more palatable drinks that replicate the flavors of beer without containing the alcohol itself that causes all the harm. And as a result of that, the industry has now been willing to produce no-low drinks under their leading brands. So we see as Heineken Zero, we see Guinness Zero, Gordon Zero, Tanqueray Zero. And that's been the big change, is we now have mass market brands that are no-low drinks that are being heavily promoted with big global marketing campaigns. And all of that ultimately raises the question, well, what is this doing for public health? Is this good for public health? Probably we would expect on the surface that it would be. And even if it is, well, what are the complexities in there? Are there things we need to worry about? Are the people who are at risk of alcohol-related harm consuming these products? And if they're not, what can we do to increase that consumption? And if there are risks, for example, I mentioned earlier the potential for problems around young people or pregnant women or people recovering from alcohol dependence, what can we do to mitigate those risks and minimize any harms while maximizing the benefits?
There are, I think, clearly some advantages and disadvantages, but of course, your research will clear a lot of that up. And we can come on to the sort of public health concerns in a bit. But first, looking at the recent publication and research that your group has published, I think will help people understand how these products are used at the moment, who buy, and any sort of barriers that people have to their uptake. What has your recent research identified as being the groups that consume these drinks, and which products? I think you mentioned those sort of branded products. Which products at the moment dominate the no-low market?
Yeah, so we've collected data in the Alcohol Toolkit survey, which is a kind of well-established academic survey that's been used to look at all sorts of elements of alcohol consumption. And we found that one in three adults drank a no-low drink in the last year, and 18%, so just under one in five, drank one in the last month. And then we looked at, well, who is drinking this? And we found it's more common for people to drink Nolo drinks if they're men, if they're heavier drinkers, and if they're from more advantaged groups, so higher socioeconomic groups. And this has been backed up in quite a lot of other studies in the UK and also in Finland and the US as well. And there's a couple of really important points here. Firstly, if Nolo drinks are going to improve public health, we need them to be consumed by heavier drinkers in place of their standard alcohol consumption. And at least from this limited evidence, we can see that that might be happening. It is heavier drinkers who are consuming these products more. So that's good. The other concern is we know a lot of the harm from alcohol is concentrated in more deprived communities. So if we're going to reduce that harm, we do using Nolo drinks, we do not need people from those more deprived communities to be consuming them. And at the moment, it looks more like it's a more advantaged groups, the higher socioeconomic groups, who are more likely to drink no and low alcohol drinks. So there is a worry here that we might get reductions in harm among richer people and continuing high levels of harm among poorer people, and thus health inequalities will widen. So one message from that is we might need more effort from government and from other people who can make a difference to increase take-up of these products among more deprived communities.
Play devil's advocate for a moment. How much does a widening of health inequality matter if nobody's getting less healthy? So if you've got those more affluent people getting healthier, but less affluent people aren't getting healthier, but are kind of staying the same, how much does that matter?
I mean, it's a really good question. At a basic level, of course, it's a good thing if someone in the population is getting healthier. But we know health inequalities really do matter. It's simply a question of societal fairness, and equity. If one group in the population has far worse health outcomes due to their social circumstances, we kind of have a moral obligation to do something about that. That doesn't mean that we should drag down everyone's health to make health more equal, but it does mean if we've got limited resources, we might want to bring up the health of the poorest in the society, those who have the worst health outcomes already, rather than focusing resources only on improving the health of the richest. And the public support this as well. In other work I've done, we found that the public are willing to invest extra resource in targeting health problems in lower income groups and sacrifice some of that resource going into richer areas to reduce health inequalities.
So with these products, the sort of obvious point is that they're presumably only more specifically helping more affluent people because they're quite expensive. And that's one of the main sort of criticisms that people have, including many of my friends, is that these products are very expensive, even though they don't have alcohol duty applied to them. And alcohol duty can make up quite a lot of the cost of certain products. Are these products more expensive? And if so, why?
It's actually a little bit complicated, this. On the surface, yes, no and low alcohol drinks are priced at a higher point than standard alcoholic drinks. But there's several reasons for that. The first one is they cost more to make. There are more manufacturing processes involved in producing a Nolo drink, partly because of this process of extracting the alcohol from them. And to do that without damaging the flavour is also quite a slow process. So companies need to keep the product on site as it's being manufactured and need more space to do that for a longer time period. So there are additional manufacturing costs. Another important point is the reason that Nolo drinks tend to be quite expensive is because they're actually premium products. A lot of the big brands in this market are not your kind of cheap bargain budget alcohol brands. They're kind of premium or at least mid-market products. So we would expect them to be quite high priced. And then the last reason here is we know that alcohol often comes in big multi-packs or large bottles. And that's true for Nolo drinks as well. But those multi-packs tend to be a bit smaller for Nolo drinks. And the bottle sizes sometimes are a bit smaller as well. So you're getting less price discount for bulk purchasing, essentially. So there's more going on here than just these products being expensive. It's partly about them being premium, it's partly about pack sizes, and it's partly genuine concerns about about manufacturing costs. Now, that said, they also don't attract any alcohol tax, so you would expect that to balance out a bit. And one thing that people should bear in mind is this isn't a static thing. Over recent years, no-low drinks have become cheaper, and that gap between standard alcoholic products and no-low products has closed a lot. And in fact, in shops and supermarkets, the average price paid for a no-low spirit is now below the price of a standard spirit. And the price difference for beer is much, much smaller than it used to be. So this isn't necessarily something that's going to stay the same over coming years.
Moving on to the concerns among the public health community, which I think you know a lot about. One of the major concerns is that the government, and therefore the time that the civil service and ministers are spending on this, is far too focused on these products, sort of to the detriment of a focus on researching, developing, delivering more evidence-based policies that we know a huge amount about. Do you think this is a legitimate concern?
I definitely think it's a legitimate concern. We know that there are things we can do that will reduce the harm from alcohol that at the moment the UK government isn't doing. For example, increasing the prices of alcohol. We saw yesterday, with recording this the day after the budget, and we saw yesterday the Chancellor chose to freeze alcohol taxes. And we know that that's likely to put upward pressure on alcohol consumption and harm. We know that better regulation of marketing would also work. So the time that government spends on developing policies for no-low drinks is time they're not spending on those other things. So that is a concern. However, there is a different argument here as well. No-low alcohol drinks are a new product, and we've seen with previous products like this, and vaping and e-cigarettes will be the most obvious example, that you do need to introduce a sensible regulatory regime around them. And if you don't, you risk creating new public health problems or exacerbating existing ones. And as a result, there, firstly, we shouldn't assume that not regulating, not focusing on no-low policy will allow us to do other good things and have no costs. There is a cost to not doing no-low policy as well. There's a risk of a regulatory failure that creates public health problems. We also know that the government will need to regulate no-low drinks anyway and will respond to industry calls for policies to be introduced. So there is going to be some kind of policy framework around these products. And that policy framework can be determined by the industry and by whoever else shouts loudest, or public health actors can take an active role in shaping that policy. So it's a question of whether we want to be involved or not in determining how no-low drinks are governed in the future. And then the last part of this argument for me is it's not clear to me that the introduction of no-low drinks and the promotion of them is actually a less effective policy. It's less well evidenced, certainly. We have very little evidence on how these drinks will affect public health at the moment, but there are good reasons to think they will actually be beneficial. In a world where public health actors have struggled to persuade governments to introduce evidence-based policies such as tax increases, such as regulation of alcohol marketing, it may actually be that it's more effective and deliver bigger public health benefits from introducing no-low drinks. And it doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. You can do both. It's not an either-or choice. And there are synergies as well. Introducing a strength-based tax system will encourage people to switch to lower-strength drinks. And having a thriving no-low market should help with that. So there are synergies that we can explore as well that mean you might actually get the best of both worlds.
On that note about marketing, one of the real concerns is that, and I appreciate your thoughts in terms of it may be lacking in evidence, but it's not necessarily therefore lacking in effectiveness. In terms of the marketing aspect of it, people worry about this sort of alibi marketing or substitute marketing, whatever, about how, I mean, Guinness already does it in the Six Nations. They do it in France because of their restrictions over the last sort of 30 years or so, and they're starting to do it in Ireland as well, where they'll push. Well, in France, they don't actually push non-alcoholic products because they've got much more restrictive rules there. But in Ireland, they have been pushing very clearly pushing non-alcoholic products, which for most people, I would assume, doesn't really look like a non-alcoholic product. It just looks like their Guinness product. They're still just marketing Guinness as a whole. And that, I think, is a real concern, that it sort of normalizes alcohol consumption, especially in areas where, like you mentioned earlier, in terms of pregnancy and maybe driving, where we've never really considered driving to be drinking to be an acceptable thing. But now if we're allowed to drink these products whilst we're driving, there's a sort of confusion and conflation in what then happens in terms of sort of normalization of it. Do you think, I mean, I guess this sort of points to your concerns about that with public health groups not getting involved, in that we do have to be involved in order to try and drive the regulation of it in the correct manner. In a sort of more specific question, what would you like to see in terms of the marketing aspect of it? Would you like to see a separation of the products, or would that maybe risk potentially losing the effectiveness of the products if they do have a strong public health element?
Yeah, I think this is a really difficult question. You touched on it a little bit there, that we know that the no-lo products that are dominating the market are ones that share their branding with a standard alcohol product. So again, we're talking about the Heineken Zeros, the Guinness Zeros, the Gordon Zeros. If these products do help public health, then it's likely that those shared branded products may have an important role to play in introducing consumers to no-lo drinks. People feel comfortable trying a drink from a brand they recognize. For all the noise about lots of small startups and independent no-lo producers, they're having a relatively small impact on the market. What's really driving this market is the major brands. That said, it's definitely a concern that no-lo products are potentially being advertised in a way that additionally promotes alcohol consumption or that undermines alcohol marketing regulations, as you mentioned, in Ireland and in relation to the Six Nations. So I think what we need is a very carefully calibrated approach to alcohol marketing that tries to ensure that no-lo products are not marketed in ways and in places that alcohol wouldn't already be marketed. That's one potential area we could look at. That they're marketed in ways that limit any sense that they might be promoting alcohol consumption, and potentially that they are marketed in a way that directly recommends substituting no-lo products for standard alcohol products. And this would go against some of the campaigns that have caused the most concern, such as Heineken's Now You Can campaign, which seemed very directly to say, you can have all your standard alcohol consumption and you can have this as well. What would be a much better approach is to say, here is a no and low alcohol drink. You can use this in place of your standard alcohol consumption, have the same flavor you enjoy, but it'll do you a lot less harm. Pushing marketing and pushing the way we think about no-low marketing more into that space, more as a kind of substitute for alcohol marketing rather as an addition to the existing alcohol marketing, I think is a way to think about this. How you do that, and particularly how you do it in digital spaces, social media and so on, needs a lot of thought. But I think getting those principles in place about what it is that no-lo marketing should and shouldn't be allowed to do, and that it's there to substitute for alcohol marketing, not to add to it, I think is a key way to think about this.
We're running out of time here. I'm sure you could speak for hours about this this topic, and I'd love to hear more. But if you were to put your soothsayer hat on and anticipate or guess what's going to happen over the next 5, 10, 15, 100 years maybe, what do you think the market will look like with regards to these products and maybe the public health implications of them?
I think there's several signs that no-lo drinks will be a substantial part of the alcohol market for the long term. The industry is invested heavily. We can see which direction the trends are going in terms of sales and the proportion of alcohol sales that are no-lo. We can also see the trends in the population as well, with young people drinking less and being less likely to drink, so potentially looking for alternatives to standard alcoholic drinks as that generation moves through a life course and starts to take up a bigger chunk of a bigger share of the population. So there's lots of reasons to think that trends will continue to go upwards. I guess the real question is, where is the ceiling and how quickly is this going to happen? So I think the ceiling is probably low, but still substantially higher than where we are now. My guess would be we'll land somewhere where no-low drinks take up to maybe 10, perhaps as much as 20% of the alcohol market. But unless we have major reform to alcohol policy, it's unlikely we're going to get to a place where alcohol starts to become a minority, standard alcoholic drinks become a minority of a market or anything like that. I think we kind of all accept there will always be a market for alcohol unless it's very heavily restricted. How quickly we'll get there, I think we're on a trend that suggests we're going to see upwards growth for at least the next 10 years. What we don't know is what new product innovations are coming along. The one thing we are aware of is that there have been new developments in the wine market and the ability to produce good tasting no-low wines, still wines, that is. We've already got some sparkling wines that people enjoy. And I think that will make a big difference. We know how much of the UK alcohol market is dominated by wine at the moment. So good no-low alternatives in that space could give the no-low market overall a bit of a kick over the next 2 or 3 years.
That is all for this month. Thank you for listening, and we hope you can join us in next month's podcast.